Hi, welcome to O'Reilly Radar. I'm Jim Stogdill. This week, John Bruner and I continued our coffee talk tour in a Detroit, Michigan cafe. In the shadow of the empty Michigan Central train station, we chatted about the collision between the second and third industrial revolutions. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
All right, we're here in Detroit. Hi, John.
Hey, Jim.
We're sitting in the shadow of the famous abandoned train station in Detroit.
That's right. In a coffee shop, a terrific coffee shop, actually.
John and I have found more good coffee in a 3-square-mile section of Detroit in the last 36 hours than we drank in Cambridge, Massachusetts, an entire week.
That's right. It's been long enough now that we can say uncharitable things about Boston again. Yeah. The coffee scene there is not the best in the country.
Now, I know that there are moments when Dunkin' is a necessary evil, but never my favorite, and I think... Dunkin' Donuts is sort of preventing Boston from coming alive as a coffee scene.
Perhaps. The people there just need to learn to let go.
Let go of the Dunkin'. Move on.
But the coffee scene here in Detroit is terrific. And as a matter of fact, Jim and I only communicate by sitting in coffee shops together.
Yeah. We just travel around the country and we meet up at coffee shops and we talk about things. Today, because we're in Detroit, we're reflecting on this collision that's happening between the second industrial age and the third. And just to put a little context in that, the first industrial age was steam driven. Second industrial age was sort of 1900, the emergence of the internal combustion engine and electrically driven factories. There was a massive productivity that came out of that. And today we're sort of in the midst of this third revolution that is simultaneously sustainable power technologies merged with the importance of networks and information technology. And I'm originally from Detroit, and John and I both make our livings in the Silicon Valley ecosystem. Neither of us actually live there.
We live in places that have better coffee than Silicon Valley.
Right, exactly. But so we've been thinking a lot about these two places as being representative of these two industrial revolution moments. And till now, they seemed like they operated in parallel but disconnected ways. But suddenly, software is eating the world, and those two revolutions are colliding, and people that used to make things are now making things that have information in them and around them and controlling them and optimizing them. And the people that made just information and built the networks and built the software and technology around that are having to figure out what things mean again and what they are and what the physical world is.
Right. And, you know, this is a particularly interesting conversation to have when you look at cars because, you know, more and more of the value of cars is in the IT that's in them. I mean, people want a car that drives well, that's comfortable, that's quiet, but the car makers are investing more and more in the quality of the entertainment and navigation experience, which is really just a software experience expressed through a pretty standard interface.
But do you think they can do that? Do you think they're really prepared for the future given the design of their organization that's been optimized for incremental innovation for so long? I mean, automobile manufacturers are actually very innovative, but it's sort of a class of innovation that's highly incrementalized.
Right. Well, I think the reason that they're so interested in platforms is that it lets them break apart the innovation cycle for their software from the innovation cycle for the hardware. You know, we often talk about software eating the world, and it's easy when you hang out with a lot of Silicon Valley people to take on sort of a glib approach where every problem in the world can be reduced to a generic software problem and solved with software. And yesterday we visited a big auto assembly plant, and it was one of the most impressive things that I've ever seen in my life. I mean, this thing is like square miles, of floor space. A car coming off the assembly line every minute, weaving back and forth across this gigantic factory floor. They take the doors off, they put the doors on. There are doors flying on belts overhead, and truck cabs going below. And it's an unbelievable operation, and it helps you understand how complicated the physical world is, and how much expertise goes into the manufacture of something like a car. And so you start to see why incremental change has to happen there.
Well, we also spent time at their R&D labs, and where you went down essentially miles and miles of corridors filled with research labs doing... we just both walked away with an amazing sense of this. In Silicon Valley, we throw around the term scale all the time.
Yeah.
There's 100,000 of something, so it's scale. The scale of effort necessary to design and build an automobile is just fascinating.
Yeah.
And so the automobile manufacturers are comfortable in their knowledge that nobody in Silicon Valley, other than perhaps Tesla, is going to figure out overnight how to do that.
Right.
But I guess the question we've been batting around is, does that even matter? Automobile manufacturers, they can do what they do because there's a lot of margin in what they do. If every automobile sale was to Avis and Hertz, they'd be very different industries because those would be sourced at scale with 10% margins on fixed bids and all that kind of thing. And that's not how they sell cars, by selling to individuals and appealing to our sort of less rational natures. They're able to make much higher margins. And one of the things we've been reflecting on is as these two worlds collide, you know, the Silicon Valley world and the manufacturing world, to what degree will the information side of that equation matter more and ultimately change the ability for Detroit and other automobile manufacturing centers to pull the value out?
Right. I mean, if Google comes out with the Google car operating system and it becomes the standard driverless car interface for every car, and suddenly everyone is driving around using it, then that becomes, you know, then a lot of the IT aspects become non-competitive. You know, if every car has the same Google operating system in it, then first of all, you know, you're paying less and less attention to the quality of your car, because if Google is driving your car, then you don't care about how the acceleration and the steering feel. You're just going to be on your iPad.
It's a personal cab.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, you can almost imagine a world where it's not even your car. It's, you know, Uber starts buying cars by the fleet, and you know it's Uber licenses Google's operating system for cars, goes
right
out and buys a fleet of automobiles that they've got bids on from from the various auto manufacturers. They pay a low margin on them, and suddenly we just Uber a car.
Right.
It's part of this sort of industrial internet stuff we've been talking about, where information has now replaced capital expense, and none of us own a car anymore.
Yeah.
We just call one when we need it.
So then how do you get people to care that the Uber driverless car that they've ordered is a Chevy versus a Ford versus a VW?
Right. Do you think, we don't really know from the conversations we've had here or elsewhere, but do you think conventional automobile manufacturers are thinking about this? Do you think they see the threat in these terms?
You know, I think.
Or do you think they're comfortable? Sorry to interrupt. Or do you think they're comfortable saying, "Look, Google doesn't know how to make a car. They never will. We're not worried."
I think it's a blend of the two. I mean, I think that they are worried about getting out-platformed by Google. I mean, the highest level, broadest platform is probably going to win unless you make your platform, your intermediate platform, really compelling from the beginning. So, you know, I think they're worried about getting out-platformed by a Google or something like that, which creates not just the platform for all GM cars, but the platform for all cars everywhere, and commoditizing the mechanical devices underneath.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think they recognize something about the massive complexity of designing and building a car.
Yeah.
And, you know, you saw this in the research labs yesterday. It was miles of, like, wet labs with test tubes and microscopes.
Yeah.
You know, here's the adhesives lab.
And
here's
the acoustic lab. And,
right. Here's the vibration lab. Here's the textiles lab. You know, it's just... and that's not even the basic research that they're doing on textiles. That's the sort of integrative research. They have to figure out not how to make an alloy lighter,
but will it matter?
But will it matter?
I mean, don't you think... The big five publishers or big six publishers were thinking, Amazon doesn't know how to acquire authors. They don't know how to edit books. They don't know how to distribute books. They don't know how to do all this stuff. And then 5 years later, or 10 years later, this upstart from Seattle has upended the entire industry. And they're the ones extracting all the value out of the chain.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, people are still publishing books, and other people are, you know, Amazon's experimenting with acquiring authors and doing their own publishing, but it's a minor part of it at this point. But it almost doesn't matter. They've reoriented the equation to the point where nobody else can pull any value out of it.
Yeah. You know, Tesla has is a startup that makes cars, and they're pretty good at it. You look at the way that Boeing is building its newer airplane, the 787, for instance, by pushing a lot of the requirements for innovation and improvement onto its vendors. So Boeing isn't fabricating, you know, the wings itself. It's telling a Japanese supplier that it has to fabricate the wings, and they have to work to within certain tolerances. And then it leaves the development and innovation to them. Boeing still has to do a lot of the integrative R&D the way that Ford does, but you could imagine that a startup car maker might work the same way. They find a promising vendor for bodies, a vendor for seats, a vendor for floor mats, and they just sort of order.
I think you're answering a little bit different question, though. I'm operating the assumption that big three automakers, for example, those type of companies would still be doing all the things they do. They still will be making the cars. They'll still be doing that kind of integrated research. They'll still be the only ones with the expertise, perhaps, because it's just such a massive scale. I'm saying I don't know if it'll matter. Like, they'll still be making cars, but their margins will be 10% because Google and Uber or whoever, or something like that, will have figured out that the information layer of this equation is much more relevant than the physical layer in terms of being able to extract value.
Right. I mean, the margins on an expensive car are so much higher than the margins on a cheap car. You know, if Google intermediates the experience of driving a car by basically driving the car for you, so that you don't really care so much about the mechanical.
Well, it's not even just that; it's that you're not the one buying it anymore. So it's not an individual one by one sale, right?
It's separate issues. You know, there's the do you care about your model car?
I mean, there could be a world that still has 500 series Mercedes, but instead of you buying it individually and them getting a 60% margin on it, Uber buys 1,000 of them and pays a 20% margin.
So this comes back to the sort of physical world as a service concept that I've been talking about with the industrial internet,
exactly,
where you know, everything can be provided as a service once it's sufficiently censored and operated remotely from sort of a cloud software perspective. So there are separate questions that we're getting confused here.
Right.
One is who's going to be buying the car of the future? There is a software aspect to that, and that comes down to the sort of physical world as a service question. And fleet sales, you know, if the auto companies find themselves selling a larger percentage of their cars in fleet sales, that's very unhealthy for them because the margins are so poor.
Right.
That's a separate question from just
do people even care about what their cars
who's
like?
Who's going to control the interaction between the driver and the car, and will that make drivers or car buyers stop caring about model of car?
It's sort of commoditization of the transaction and commoditization of the experience as two separate things.
Right. Say 20% of the value of your car experience is like the sort of round entertainment experience in the car. You know, if every car has the same one, then and it's all Google and it's all sort of served through someone else's service, then that could be quite painful.
Well, there's also just the macro element, which is if you can imagine a future where every car was self-driving and every car was owned by a fleet and responding like an Uber, there's a lot fewer cars. It's just a massive efficiency and optimization that comes from that, and so there's a third as many cars that even need to be built.
Sure. Well, that's part of another part of the industrial internet report is that, you know, the better controls mean fewer assets. You know, if you can distribute the assets more efficiently across demand, then you need fewer assets.
Yeah. It's interesting. We went to the mind of machines thing that GE put on, and you know, Jeff Immelt made a similar point when he said, "Look, we know it's really hard to make aircraft engines. We know." You know, upstart from Silicon Valley is going to be making aircraft engines tomorrow, but he also acknowledged they recognize the importance of the information layer in there. And, you know, to speak really frankly, you'd have to imagine that. You know, I have not had this conversation with Jeff Immelt, but I would have to imagine that he would, when he sits around and thinks about it, he's like, yeah, I make the things, but I can't have IBM taking all the profit by tying them together under a smarter planet kind of thing. Like, they need to know that the things plus the information layer they're adding still maintain the value.
Yeah, so if the value is in the information layer, who is capturing the value? Is it the car maker that provides the information layer and captures the value, or is it someone else who sort of forces their way into the car?
Right. And you know, we see with like Facebook's open compute initiative that, you know, you see these spaces that you didn't imagine becoming really open commodities suddenly becoming open commodities. I mean, this is really crazy because, I mean, who knows, someday we'll be having, you know, you and I 20 years from now might be having this conversation reflecting on how, isn't it strange that now all cars are the same and they're open hardware? And the information layer is the only part that matters, and who would have ever seen that coming? That sounds insane to say today, but we didn't see a lot of this stuff coming.
Well, so there is a good parallel to the worst case scenario for car makers is sort of a parallel to PC makers, right? Where like no one cares anymore if a PC is built by Dell or HP or, you know, Lenovo or Acer or whatever. They're all just absolutely commoditized, and all that matters is the software on them. And increasingly, it doesn't even matter that you have a powerful computer, because everything is happening in the cloud, where the software is really the only thing that matters. You can take any number of commodity computers, and all of the performance improvements, all of the value add is from the software.
Yeah, it almost seems like if you were trying to think about how you'd compete in this space today, it would be about having the most efficient platform, so that so that you have something to offer those fleet providers as well, or those potential consumers that may not care anymore about the user experience of driving as much as they used to, but still will care about the cost of operating at a level.
Yeah. So, you know, the car makers will have to be careful, because there are things that they could do to their cars that will make them more attractive to the fleet buyers if they're making a lot of fleet sales, and they'll have to be careful to avoid the kind of thing that we observe with our terrible corporate travel booking system that we were talking about last night, where a feature is or a product is transparently built for the person who purchases it, who is not the person who uses it, right? You know, we were talking about this last night with our sort of in-house travel booking tool, which is a terrible user experience for those of us who are booking travel, but the product is clearly targeted at the sort of accounts payable.
I just had a chill go down my spine. You know, God save us from cars that are like enterprise software, and because of the same dynamic.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. You know, cars are sold to fleets on the basis of their maintenance. You know, automated maintenance and
the equivalent
asset
of,
tracking.
The car equivalent of single sign-on or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Then the customer, the driver of the car, is going to suffer from that.
Right. So it's the cheapest car on the road. Too bad the seats feel like pebbles.
Right. You know. So the thing that the car makers have realized, and this is something that I sense when we talk to the car makers, that they've realized that the IT layer and the entertainment layer and the navigation layer and so forth are going to be one of the most effective ways that they can remain in communication with drivers, regardless of how the car is actually delivered, whether it's sold to the consumer or rented to the consumer by an intermediary. It's the interface, the software interface, that can remain a really compelling way of communicating. And I would say, as someone who doesn't own a car but rents them all the time, it's gotten to the point where I'm pretty indifferent to the make and model of the car that I rent, as long as it has a USB port so that I can plug my phone in and use the navigation system in Google Maps and listen to the music that I want to listen to. But the quality of the drive and the comfort of the seat and so forth are just pretty hard to distinguish. But I really want a car that has a good software interface.
Yeah. So we're going to wrap this up, but just final question. If you were running an automobile company, how scared would you be of Google right now?
That's a good question. I'd say 6 on a scale of 1 to 10. Yeah. I really do think that past experience in industries like the PC industry aside, Silicon Valley, the software industry tends to make this pretty bold assumption that everything can be reduced to a software problem and value captured by the highest level of software. Mm-hmm. And that's a really bold thing to say.
One thing that automobile manufacturers have going for them in all this is tremendous cultural inertia. There are a lot of people in this country that even if it was cheaper, faster, easier to use to Uber a car to your door and it would always be there in 30 seconds, lots and lots of us wouldn't be ready to do that tomorrow. But I think it might happen faster than we imagine. I'm often surprised how quickly things happen.
It might, yeah. You know, if the costs are really compelling, if gas prices go up and someone else, some service provider is able to absorb the risk of gas prices going up, then that could be pretty compelling. You know,
yeah. And if you could for $500 a year, essentially, you know, at the net jet of cars or timeshare of cars,
yeah,
rather
exactly.
than owning a $40,000 car yourself or $30,000 or whatever,
yeah.
it could be really compelling.
Yeah, the classic example of physical world as a service is that instead of instead of ordering electricity from your utility, you instead buy a contract that yeah. sets the interior temperature of your house within a comfortable margin, and the equivalent of that. And the utility maintains your air conditioner, maybe installs a more efficient air conditioner, maintains your furnace. The equivalent of that in cars could be quite compelling if you're forcing some service provider to take on the risk of rising gas prices or the risk of maintenance or something like that. And it makes it predictable, and it could make it very economically compelling because you're not making the capital investment in something that sits in your driveway 23 and a half hours per day.
Yeah. All right, John, let's head to the airport. I'll see you in a coffee shop in some other part of the country soon.
Excellent. Thanks. All right.